Well, it's not a hurricane right now, technically, but Harvey is still doing damage in Texas and other areas of the Gulf. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. With all the extreme weather going on, we certainly have lots to talk about with our weather guys. Steve Ackerman couldn't be with us today, but John Martin is here. He's a professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. We'll talk a bit about Hurricane Harvey and hurricanes in general. And as always, we'll take your weather-related questions. So I hope you'll give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. And you can always join us on Facebook. Look for the title, The Larry Mueller Show, and share your cool weather photos with us as well. I really enjoy seeing those photos, and John, you do as well.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely.
Well, the Gulf Coast was hit by a monster hurricane this weekend. How did it form? How did it form?
Well, this one formed relatively quickly, although I will say people were kind of talking about it even as early as the end of last weekend, saying, hey, watch out in the western Gulf of Mexico by the end of the week. Looks like something could develop. So there are disturbances in the upper atmosphere as well as ones that reach all the way to the ground and they get connected. There are certain conditions that are required to allow complexes, that is, collections of tropical thunderstorms, to get themselves organized into a hurricane. One of the main characteristics of the environment that has to be obeyed is that there can't be any difference in the wind speed and direction from the ground all the way up to about 10 miles above the ground.
Wow.
Wind shear. That's rare. Those conditions are rare, but when they occur in conjunction with something that's triggering a collection of thunderstorms, those thunderstorms can start to organize themselves into something that is self-sustaining, a heat engine-type disturbance, which is a tropical storm. And then if the tropical storm remains isolated from this vertical wind shear and keeps it out of play, it can develop very rapidly. And that's actually what happened during the day on Friday for Harvey. It went from Category 2 to Category 4 by the time it hit the coast, and that was a fairly rapid development.
And the path of Harvey was, sort of like kept circling over the same area
and
almost.
It's coming off the coast a little bit today, and it's likely to go back north toward Houston again for a return visit to Houston over the next day or two. This is actually related and connected somehow to the idea that the storm, when it first formed, was divorced from any other disturbances in the atmosphere. That's what keeps it insulated against the vertical shear that can kill it. And that hasn't changed over the last couple of days. This storm is moving around by its own agency. It's not being blown around by any other larger scale disturbance in the atmosphere. And that makes it even more difficult to deal with.
And so basically it picks up water from the Gulf in this case.
That's right.
Carries it over the land and drops it on the land.
Yeah, the hurricanes are fueled by evaporation off the ocean. So air that comes in from remotely from the far reaches of the hurricane is warmed as it comes in, but as it's warmed, it evaporates water, and so it keeps some of its, it's able to scour the surface of the ocean for water vapor through evaporation and turns it into thunderstorms and rain, as they're seeing in eastern Texas and Louisiana today.
Now, this may be an odd question, but something I just thought about, I wondered if it's picking up all that water, it's salt water. Does that, could that have an impact on the soil itself? I mean, obviously, with the flooding, that's a terrible thing. Would there be a long-term impact, or is the salt somehow not present in the water when it falls?
It's not present in any serious concentration, because the water that falls as rain is almost 100% pure.
Okay.
And what's left in the ocean is a little bit higher salt content.
Gotcha.
So you're taking water off. However, when you get a storm surge, the water that comes straight off the ocean in waves and on the surge, that can do damage to arable land. I think most of the coast is probably not arable in the sense that you're doing, you're growing corn, wheat, and soybeans in that soil. It's sandy. But if it were arable and it's inundated by salt water, there's repercussions for that, for sure.
Oh, my goodness. And just to think about a city of what?
Houston? 6 million plus. It's the fourth largest city in the United States.
And how much water? They're basically under.
I think the airport has had 25 inches as of early this morning. Of rain. And there's a place to the southwest of the center of the city that had 27. And there's more to come. there might be twice as much more to come. So it's unimaginable. I mean, really, we have on average here in Madison, we have, I think, 30 or so inches of liquid equivalent precipitation a year, closer maybe to 40. And they're getting it all in 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
All of what we get in a year. It's amazing.
Well, speaking of measurable, I think Frank in La Crosse County has something for us relating to that. Frank, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a trivia question for you. If the Weather Service predicts rain, how much has to fall for them to claim we got it right?
I believe it's a hundredth of an inch is the first measurable amount, although there's also a category with less than that amount called a trace. So if I were the one making the forecast and I said, I think it's going to rain tomorrow and there's a trace of rain, I still might consider it a successful forecast, but it wouldn't be measurable until a hundredth of an inch of rain has accumulated.
So you'd only call it a trace.
That's correct. And that's the official designation as well.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in too. 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you. Carol emailed to say, her local weather man said the temperature will never get lower than the dew point. Is that true? What about in the winter if it's below zero? She doesn't recall a dew point of 20 below zero.
Oh, yeah. It happens all the time. So,
it does.
Yeah, that's a correct statement, that the temperature can never go below the dew point, because the dew point is the temperature at which the water vapor in the air will start to condense into liquid water. So even when the air is really cold and consequently really dry in the middle of the winter, even in a desperately cold winter, you might have a temperature of minus 20, but your dew point will be minus 22. So what that says is you better get me down to minus 22 before you can get any water to condense out of this. And in that case, we'd turn to ice first.
Oh, so, my goodness me. Are we going to be affected, or how is Wisconsin weather affected by or will it be affected by Hurricane Harvey?
It doesn't look like we're in line for receiving any effect from Harvey. Although this is not something that you can say out of hand, that, you know, when you get a hurricane in the Texas Gulf Coast, it never affects us. It's not true. This time, one of the reasons Harvey is isolated and kind of sitting still is because there are weather systems at higher latitudes over the central part of the continent that are kind of parading across and insulating it from moving northward. In August of 2007, it might have been 2008, I think it was 2008, we had that disastrous flood where Gays Mills was flooded out and various other places. That was exactly a consequence of a landfalling, in that case, tropical storm. It wasn't a hurricane in Texas. That was all that water vapor from the tropics was entrained in a weather system that was making its way eastward and was brought far enough north to give us an exceptional rain event.
So
it can happen,
but
not this time.
Tab in Mazamani, it's your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. This morning, the Wisconsin State Journal had an article about the University of Wisconsin contribution to tracking the hurricane, and I wondered if the professor would elaborate on that, and I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
All right, thanks for calling.
That's Steve and I contribute a weekly column to the Wisconsin State Journal, and that's the one. So this weekend I happened to write it. Steve was on his way to South Africa. The University of Wisconsin, surprisingly, in some ways surprisingly, in other ways not so surprisingly, has a major role to play in both the monitoring and in the forecasting of tropical storms in the Atlantic and the Pacific Basin. And the Atlantic Basin is the one we're talking about today. And here's why. The University of Wisconsin is the place on Earth where satellite meteorology was effectively invented by Werner Sumi, and then we have a Space Science and Engineering Center. Steve directs SIMS, the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. We have a 60-plus, almost 70-year history of our department, and about a 60-year history of the Space Science and Engineering Group, with the first satellites being launched in the late 50s. So, no place on Earth has done more of that than us, and we have, as a consequence, had a long-standing historical presence in satellite meteorology, and one of the outgrowths of that presence has been a really superb group down in SIMS that monitors the intensity of tropical cyclones by looking at radiative properties from satellites. Especially looking into the eye, you can tell how warm the air is, and that'll tell you something about how intense the storm is. Also, since these storms form over the oceans, exclusively, and the oceans only have a few ships of opportunity for observations, satellite observations of clouds at and winds as a consequence of seeing the clouds at a variety of levels above the ocean surface tell us whether or not the environment is ripe for the development of tropical cyclones. And that's extremely important information for input into numerical forecast models.
And so others come to Wisconsin, to the UW sites, or how does it work?
Yeah, if there's a, let's say the National Hurricane Center wants to run its forecast model for what's happening, or Princeton University wants to run, the GFD lab wants to run its hurricane model, they will... they have, you know, relationships with SIMS, and SIMS can send them the wind information for inputting into their model. And I think they've probably worked collaboratively to figure out how to get that to work. But now those avenues are open. And so some of the top-level people, I shouldn't say top, maybe middle-level people, soon to be top-level people at the Hurricane Center are Wisconsin grads, because the Hurricane Center wants to hire people who have this experience. So we have some really top, you know, really influential people there. So it's interesting.
Yeah, very cool. Jane in Ashland, it's your turn. Hi, Jane.
Yeah. I have a satellite photograph of the Hurricane Katrina approaching New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It's huge. It hasn't arrived yet. But what information can meteorologists derive from such photos in order to tell people what to do?
Yeah, that's a good question. Some of the things are very obvious. Imagine, I think you probably mean you're looking at a movie of these images, or is it just one?
It's a photograph.
Okay, yeah. We can make movies of a series of such images. And so from that, especially with something like Katrina or Harvey, where an eye came up late for Harvey, but it came up and it was quite obvious for a short time before it made landfall, you can actually start to see what the exact path of the center of the storm is. And it is likely to deviate a little bit from its past history. But in the last, let's say in the last 6 hours, if you can have a series of 12 images, half an hour each time, and then you can get a nice picture of how it's moved in 6 hours, it's not likely to make a right turn in the next half hour. So you can really say something about what's going to happen in the next half hour, hour and a half for the center of that storm. That's obvious, but useful. Then there's other things that the satellite information has beyond just taking a picture, that it tells us something about radiation properties of the clouds and various things, and we can figure out something about the intensity and then relay new information to forecast models.
And we'll talk some more about that. Thanks, Jane. We'll take a quick look at the news, then we'll be back with our guest, John Martin. Stay with us. Like a lot of people, we're talking about hurricanes today on the Ideas Network, at least in part. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us. The weather guys stop by once a month. Today we have just one weather guy, John Martin, with us, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve Ackerman's on his way to South Africa as we speak and couldn't be with us. You may have some questions about hurricanes, or maybe just weather questions in general. For sure, you can join in. Call us at 800-642-1234. Send us an email at ideas@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and we always like to see your weather photos, so don't be afraid to post those as well. John, we've got Diana in Blair, Wisconsin, with a question for us. Diana, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Yes, I was wondering if all the fires out west, like in Montana and British Columbia, if they have had any effect on our weather, and I'll listen on the radio.
All right. Thank you for calling.
They do have a discernible effect on the sky. I'm not sure I'd say they have an effect on the weather. I think it was Friday that I was walking out after work, and it was a sunny day. If it wasn't Friday, it was Saturday. And I noticed that near sunset, 6:30 to 7:30, the sky looked very different than it had all summer long. And it wasn't very humid. It wasn't humid near the ground or aloft, and I knew that from observations. And I thought, maybe this is the fires. And so when you get smoke particles in the sky, it changes the scattering characteristics of the atmosphere. And so it can enhance or some of the colors and take away from some of the other ones. And I think it takes away from the blue because the smoke particles are bigger than the air molecules by a lot. So it changes the scattering properties and made everything look kind of hazy, even though there was no haze. And that's a common effect of the smoke in the sky when it's in low concentration, you're far from the fire. But that's it, as far as I can tell. And there's going to be a little bit of a diminishment of the amount of radiation that hits the ground from the sun, but it doesn't really affect our weather very much, per se.
You know, I was outside for the eclipse when we were sort of at peak at 85%. Mm-hmm. And to me, I looked, the color of the air It was almost a more of a yellow cast to it.
Yeah, too bad it was cloudy here because I think you see that a little bit more. I'd never seen something as much as 85%. Many of my colleagues were on the road looking for it at 100% and found it. And they say the totality, they'd seen things close to 85% before, and they thought, well, totality won't be that much different. They were all speechless. They said it's entirely different. And even, and here's an effect about the weather. People in a couple of places, one in western Nebraska, one in Carbondale, mentioned that cumulus clouds seemed to react to the diminution of the sun, so that they kind of just scaled back. The cumulus were building, and these people were getting nervous they were going to miss the eclipse because a cumulus might get in front. And when the sun went away for those 2 minutes, the clouds actually visibly got smaller because they responded to the lack of insulation. Isn't that incredible?
Wow, so that's something I hadn't heard.
So keep in mind, I'm keeping it in mind for myself, is it 2024, the next total eclipse? And Carbondale is going to be on the path again. So 2 times in 7 years, a total eclipse, and that's only 6 hours away. I'm there next time.
Yeah.
I'm going.
I'm thinking I'm going to go, too. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah, they just were speechless.
And Washington Post put together a video show of about 4 or 5 minutes on just reactions. Mm. It was really... I watched that and I thought, why wasn't I there somewhere?
One of my colleagues in particular, sort of one of those people who's rather hard to impress, he was impressed.
Well, let's see if we can impress Mary from South Range with an answer to her question. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are the locations of lightning strikes on Earth detected, and where can the public find that information?
Yeah, I don't know about exactly the technology, Mary, but I do know this. Now, you ever listen to, baseball games on AM radio, something on AM radio at night in the summertime, and you hear those little pfft like that when there's lightning in the area?
Uh-huh.
That's radio waves being interrupted by the electricity from the lightning strike, the radiation from the lightning strike. And it's a very similar kind of technology at its base that's used, if you have 3 different station towers, you can figure out where that interruption came from geographically. So you can spot where the lightning came from by something that's related to that. And then they can also tell whether it's in cloud or cloud to cloud or cloud to ground lightning. So there's different kinds of ways to determine that, which I'm not very familiar with. Where you can find it, our department webpage, which is at www.aos.wisc.edu, has several different headings that you can hit once you get to the landing page. One of them is weather. And under the weather set of options, there'll be something that has to do with observations, or it might even say NEXRAD or lightning. Just search around through observations or radar, and one of those things, I wish I knew right off the top of my head, will land you to a place where we collect national lightning detection information. So you can see the last 5 minutes lightning strikes across the country, and then you can see those that are 15 minutes old, and you can watch a movie to see how they're moving.
Thank you.
The country. So it's really very dramatic.
That sounds really cool.
It's cool. It is cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks again. And what's the site again?
It's www.aos.wisc.edu. And while I've got your attention for addresses, I want to make an announcement if I could, Larry.
Yeah.
Marshall Shepard, who's the host of Weather Geeks on the Weather Channel and is a professor at University of Georgia, is going to be giving a public lecture on Thursday, September 7th, sponsored by our department, at the DeLuca Forum at the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, 7 p.m. Thursday, the 7th of September. This guy is a great speaker. He's going to talk about communicating weather and climate issues across a broad spectrum of, the society. Really going to be interesting.
He has some Wisconsin ties, does he not? Or not?
I don't know if Marshall has Wisconsin ties. He's had several of us on his show, which is now a famous show. Which is really fun. But he's a great guy, great speaker, very friendly person, and he's hoping to meet a bunch of people. So
again, the date is...
It's September 7th,
all right.
And that'll be at 7 p.m. in the Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, the big DeLuca Forum.
Let's go to Mike in Lake Mills next. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I realize that you can't say how much global warming affects one particular storm, but I wonder if your speaker could talk about what are the projected effects of global warming on the intensity, frequency of hurricanes and the like?
Yeah, there are some statistical studies that have suggested if you go out 50 or 100 years into the future that it's not likely that we're going to have more tropical storms, but we may have a larger fraction of intense tropical storms that make up the total number that come every year. So I'm not an expert in exactly how they've come to that conclusion. But that's anyway, that's maybe what something we might look for in the future, that if you have 10 tropical storms per year and only one of them currently reaches Category 4, it might be true that two or three of them 50 years from now reach Category 4 under a similar size population of 10. In terms of its effect on Harvey or any other individual storm, it's very, very difficult to make a conclusive case about how the gradually changing but discernibly changing climate has an impact on individual storms. There's one way that I like to think about it is that the warmer the planet gets, and it's gotten about a degree and a half Celsius warmer over the last 100 or so years, the more water vapor is in the atmosphere. There's almost no way that can't be true. And so, especially in the tropical regions, that has an influence on how much water is available for condensing into liquid and the release of latent heat by that condensation process, what fuels the storms. So it's hard to imagine that we don't have some impact of global warming on these storms, but there may well be countervailing impacts that kind of work against them getting more intense or becoming more frequent. So anyway, I think the jury's out a little bit, except on the notion that there may be a higher incidence of intense storms, but not a larger number overall.
There we go. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate the call. Kind of going along with that a little bit, Dave in La Crosse wonders if the water in the Gulf is warmer than normal, and if so, did that contribute?
I think there's two ways to measure the heat, and one of them has been longstanding sea surface temperature. So that's one way to measure it. And the sea surface temperatures were very warm. I don't know if they were record warm. But the other is to integrate the heat content of the ocean through a depth and figure out, by doing that, something called oceanic heat content. And I think the heat content in the western Gulf of Mexico was at a fairly unusually high level. And that is a big impact on these storms. So, the skin surface of the ocean has to be warm for sure. But if you have cold water right underneath the surface warmth, it's not going to last very long. It's not going to power the storm. If it's a deep layer of warm water, like it seems to be now, that's a whole different story and may well have been a contributing factor. And it's not impossible to trace that back to a generally warmer planet.
All right, let's take some more calls. Again, you can join in with your questions. We're talking hurricanes and tornadoes and other things as well. Any climate and weather question at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Bruce in Northfield next. Hi, Bruce. Thank you for calling.
How timely. Tornadoes and hurricanes. I'm curious. I know the structure of a tornado has a central updraft. But I've always thought that the downdraft in the eye of a hurricane is one of the characteristics that distinguish it from a tornado. Because you get wind speeds that are similar. So can you talk a little bit about the physics of the comparing the two?
Yeah, there's the tornado wind speeds far exceed the wind speeds in association with a hurricane. Although, of course, the tornado wind speeds are very much more local. They might affect just your backyard in the most extreme local case, more likely your neighborhood. Hurricanes are much larger scale weather systems, and the wind speeds in the central eye, which surrounds, or the eye wall, which surrounds the eye, which you correctly said, Bruce, is a region of gentle subsidence. The air is actually sinking through the eye. That's what makes it clear. That's what makes the clear skies clear. But on the eye wall, the thunderstorms there can have winds, horizontal winds, as we saw with Harvey, of 130 miles per hour, gusting to 155, and they can be stronger and stronger hurricanes. As they were with Katrina over the Gulf of Mexico. But they're very different kinds of storms. The tornado is formed by reorienting what is vertical wind shear into horizontal wind shear. It's one element of the process within the context of one really intense thunderstorm, whereas a hurricane is a collection of many hundreds of intense thunderstorms all working symbiotically to produce this this beast of a disturbance. And it has to, it can only be produced in certain environments, so much larger scale.
Hmm. And this time I'm glad Bruce brought this up too, because this time, along with the hurricane, then there were tornadoes.
That's a very common artifact of hurricane landfall. When the wind speeds, the horizontal wind speeds in the hurricane vortex make landfall, they get slowed down by friction with the land, and invariably they spin up little vortices, sometimes in the form of tornadoes. Very uncommon is an intense tornado in that environment. They don't seem to ever get above EF0 or EF1, the kind that can shed, branches off of trees. So there can be local damage that's fairly intense from a tornado spawned by a hurricane, but most of the time they're among the weakest tornadoes that you know, places we'll ever see, including in the midst of a severe weather outbreak.
Hmm. Interesting. Bruce, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. This summer has, this has certainly been a cool summer, I think we could say. Does it look like, why did that happen? And does it look like this trend is going to extend into the fall, do you think?
Yeah, I'm not sure why it happened. Part of the thing about this summer was that July was rainy. I mean, it rained on a lot of days. We didn't really have an a recordly excessive amount of rain, but we did beat the monthly average by a couple of inches, if I recall. But the number of days on which it rained in July was a lot, approaching 20 out of the 31, I think. And that means it's cloudy a lot of the time, and that's going to hurt your temperature. This month hasn't really been that rainy. In fact, I think the first time it rained substantially was just the other night at my house. But it's just been cool. I think it's been and dry. It hasn't been too humid. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you just get locked into a pattern where the flow predominantly is from the north or northwest in the late part of the summer, and that can give you a relatively cool month of August, and we were lucky enough to have that. It also is the reason why we're insulated from any substantial effect from Harvey. So that's a good side effect of that.
Dennis in Two Rivers up next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I was just wondering, as far as tornadoes, I've heard various things, but do they form from the clouds down or from the ground up, or does it just depend on conditions?
That's a very good question. I'm not an expert in tornado genesis. One of my colleagues is probably the world expert, in fact. And I'm trying to recall what he would probably say in response to this. I think that various things have to be occurring right near the surface to make the tornado funnel make its way down toward the ground. But I think predominantly the rotation that is eventually manifest in the tornado is generated in the middle part of the atmosphere under the influence of the vertical motions in the severe thunderstorm environment. So there have to be conditions that will meet what's going on in the middle and upper troposphere, but they are not initiated really near the ground.
Okay, because I was just wondering sometimes if it's because of wind shear or warm humid air cooling, then going downward, and then warmer air going up, and then they just kind of start spinning and forming between the clouds and the ground.
Well, you're right about wind shear. In fact, not just changes in speed, but changes in direction in the environment of a severe thunderstorm are really critically important for the development of tornadoes within that severe thunderstorm. So that has to be met. And but the warm and cool air, they don't have an ability to really retain their warmth or their cold for very much time, because when they're moving up and down, the temperatures get changed substantially. Cold air that sinks warms up, and warm air that rises cools off.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more the rotation than it is the temperatures.
And then just kind of start swirling around each other, or is that still hard to determine?
No, there is something called vorticity, which is a measure of how the air will swirl horizontally, and you can measure that on both large and small scales. And it's the intensification of that swirl that's a function of the air converging toward a central point that really spins up the rotation in a tornado.
Hmm.
So we can actually measure that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for calling. And Carol, in Appleton, it's your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. How are you?
Great.
Actually, I'm on Highway 10 heading west, and I'm close to the New London off-ramp right now. But be that as it may, last week when I was at the eclipse in southern Illinois, I actually did see the clouds start to dissipate.
Yeah.
And that happened when we got past about the 75 to 80%, and there were lots of clouds moving through, and people were being a little worried. And then all of a sudden you said, look, those clouds are shrinking.
Yeah.
And they really did shrink, and it took a while for them to build back up, but they didn't build back up as much because, again, the sun was lower in the sky after the eclipse.
Yeah, I'm glad you saw that. It sounds like the exact same testimony that I got from my colleague who was in Carbondale also. And he said it was just phenomenal. He was getting nervous, exactly what you said, Carol. He's getting nervous, and he's a nervous guy. That, you know, these clouds are headed towards the sun. And boom, when it got to a fairly high percentage of obscuration, the clouds shrunk away, and it was just perfect.
They absolutely
yeah,
did. They
that's
absolutely
awesome.
Did. Yep, it really happened. Okay, my other question was, this Harvey is acting like the classic stuck upper air low. And, I mean, those are the kinds of things that seem to be more common these days. Is there any statistics on that?
I'm not sure there are. We get cutoff lows over us, not hurricane-type cutoff lows.
Oh, right, yeah.
In May and June, you know, sometimes Memorial Day will be really miserable, and it's because you got a cutoff over you. I don't think they're any more common than they used to be. And Javi is, as we've said a couple times today, that one of the interesting things about Javi is that it's so strongly divorced from the rest of the flow in the over North America that it's going to play by its own rules. So that does tend to happen with these tropical disturbances from time to time. Once in a while, though, they get entrained into the mid-latitude flow and they just disappear from the tropics quite rapidly. Not so for Javi.
No, not for this one.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. Gail sent us a cool photo on Facebook, and I've enlarged it here on Facebook, and wonders if, John, if you can explain why the sun behind a cloud created the rainbow-like strips that you can clearly see.
And right on the edge of the clouds where they're illuminated most strongly by the sun. I'm going to guess those clouds look like cirrocumulus clouds, and so they're going to have a little bit of ice at the top is my guess. I can't tell. It's nice sometimes to see the horizon. You could see how high they might be. I'm going to guess they're mid-level clouds. But if it's a recent day, then probably they're deep enough to be above the freezing level. And so there'll be a little bit of ice at the top of those clouds. And it's the ice, it's refraction through the ice that gives that sort of rainbow-looking halo almost effect on the highly illuminated sides of the clouds. So that's my guess.
That is really a cool photo. Thank you, Gail, for sending that. Well, what does the weather look like coming up in the next few days across Wisconsin?
Looks pretty nice in the southern part of the state, I guess. Probably most of the state. I think it's going to stay moderate, not cold, maybe a little chilly at night. For some people's taste, we might get lows in the low 50s. We had our first in the 40s at my house the other day. We had 49 early in the morning, so that season's upon us, but probably not going to be repeated the next 4 or 5 days. And then highs in the mid-70s, so really quite nice, almost autumnal weather. I think it'll be really spectacular.
Oh, in our last minute or two, you talked about the really cool work that's going on with hurricane watching and analysis here at the UW-Madison. What's some of the other research that's going on here?
There's a whole bunch of it. Let me just tell you one thing I'm thinking about right now, and I'm trying to write to the Navy to see if they want to fund this research. I got this notion that in the late part of the summer, right now into September, there's a big meanders in the subtropical jet stream that can come all the way up to southern Minnesota. And at the same time, the Arctic has a whole bunch of little vortices spinning around it, and the potential for developing really intense late summer Arctic cyclones at high latitude is really peaks right now. And the reason why that matters is because this is at the end of the summer, and the Arctic ice has been thinned by the warming of the summertime. And then these strong cyclones, if they develop, they don't develop every year, but if they develop, they can kind of break up the ice just by strong wind and wave action. And so it's a really bad thing to be losing the ice to the extent that we're losing it at the end of every summer now. And so we're hoping that we can get a look at that.
Wow.
That's pretty neat.
Yeah, that is very, very neat. And let's see, if I got anything else? I think I've completely run out of questions.
This is amazing, Larry. This is unprecedented. It's like Javi.
Well, yeah, I guess sometimes I'm like Harvey. I'm a little bit unexpected. I may cause some rain to fall. But you know what, John? It's always a pleasure to have you with us.
Same here. Thank you for having me.
And you're going to be back on Monday, September 25th.
Yeah. We'll be in school then, won't we?
Yeah, we'll be in school and things will be going strong. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you, Larry.
John Martin is our guest today. John is a professor, former chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the UW-Madison, and he'll be back. And Steve Ackerman probably joining us then as well. Steve, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and he's a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Tomorrow, Shirley Bauman's going to be back to talk with us about antiques and collectibles. And I have a friend who's got a collectible that could be worth a lot of money, so I'm going to talk with her about that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.